This is the November-December edition of Ask, Science and Exploration for Curious Kids. The cover of the magazine features our cartoon characters building things, and the title of the magazine is Make It. Page 2. Nosy News by Tracy von der Brink. Sea Snacks. How would you learn how often lobsters and stingrays snack on shelled sea creatures? Would you think of making them a tasty treat to find out? That's what a group of students at Northwestern University did with the help of Chicago's Shedd Aquarium. The students started with a powder made from ground-up oyster shells. It took months of trying, but at last they created a dough that hardens when baked. They shaped the dough to look like conches, marine snails many predators enjoy. To make the baked shells even more tempting, the students filled them with a soft seafood filling. They named their creation gastropops. When placed in the water, the smell of the gastropops brings hungry lobsters, stingrays, and more. The gastropops swell up when wet, so they stay in place until something nibbles on them. By studying how many gastropops get eaten and where, researchers can identify areas with fewer ocean predators. This information will help track the health of marine ecosystems and aid conservation efforts. Zia says, "Why gastropops?" Puck says, "It's a play on words. A gastropod is a snail." High-speed hippos. There is a photograph of a hippopotamus. Hippos may weigh more than 3,000 pounds, 1,360 kilograms, but they are still able to run as fast as 14 miles per hour, 30 kilometers per hour, on land. That's faster than many people. A new study has shown that even though hippos are heavy, some lift all four legs off the ground when running. Hippos are dangerous, so to study how they move, a team of scientists from the Royal Veterinary College used video to watch them from a distance. They filmed 32 hippos and then watched them run. They discovered that hippos move fast enough that sometimes their feet don't touch the ground. In fact, scientists found that the fastest hippos spent about 15% of their running time in the air. The study also found that hippos trot, moving their front foot and opposite back foot at the same time. Other animals, such as horses, move from a walk to a trot to a gallop, but not hippos, they only trot. A baby pygmy hippo was filmed galloping, so next the scientists want to see if other baby hippos can gallop, and if they lose the skill as they grow. Plush Potum says, "I feel the need for speed." A new kind of air ball. Basketballs are filled with air to make them bounce when they hit the ground. But over time, all that bouncing wears down the basketball and can cause leaks. Without air, a basketball loses its bounce and its fun. Thanks to 3D printing, a sporting goods company called Wilson might change that. Wilson's designers used a 3D printer to create the first airless basketball. Instead of being leather and rubber like other basketballs, the basketball is made of a special, bouncy, elastic material. It's not filled with air either. Its surface was printed in a honeycomb pattern of holes so that air flows through the ball. That means it will never deflate. It took Wilson 3 years to create its airless ball. Players who tried it said it feels like a regular basketball, and it's the same size and weight. You won't see airless balls on most basketball courts soon, though. Wilson made only 75, and each one cost $2,500. The company says it plans to keep testing and improving its invention, so someday you might be able to play a game with a 3D printed airless ball. Marvin says, holding a basketball, "Just call me Air Marvin." I'm going to skip Nestor's doc and turn to page 6. Making Books. Questions by Avery. meet award-winning author and illustrator Megan McCarthy. She describes her books as fun, informative, humorous, and unique. I agree. I love them. There's an illustration of Megan. Megan is known for drawing characters with big round eyes. How do you like her self-portrait? Did you always want to be an author / illustrator? I did, along with dozens of other professions, such as becoming an FBI agent or an Olympian. But my dad wanted to be a professional artist, so he was always painting and drawing, and I loved copying what he was doing. If he did a self-portrait, then I made one. If he drew his hand, then I'd draw a hand. He showed me the works of famous artists and explained what kinds of mediums they used. I was also fascinated by my dad's large art book collection. There are some photographs of Megan. One is labeled, "Megan liked playing firefighter when she was young." How did you learn to draw? Art education in my elementary school was mainly creating turkey hands and cutting out snowflakes for decoration. So my parents paid my neighbor to give me art lessons. She was also a hobby artist. By the time I reached high school, I was into painting photorealism. My teacher was a Rhode Island School of Design alumni, so he pushed me to apply there and help me create a winning portfolio. I majored in illustration while at RISD, and the rest is history. In the photograph, as a kid, Megan drew her family's minibus. Later, the vehicle starred in one of her first books, The Adventures of Patty and the Big Red Bus. Your first books were fiction picture books, but now you mostly write and illustrate nonfiction books. Do you like nonfiction better? After I moved to New York City, I got a job in the children's department at the flagship Barnes & Noble bookstore. I was working there when my first book was published. It didn't last on the shelves very long. Part of my job was to scan book barcodes to look for returns. If the scanner tool beeped, then the book was on the list of titles to return to the publisher to make room for newer books. Well, my first book beeped only 2 months after it arrived at the store. My heart sank. The same thing happened to my second fiction book. Every day we'd get cartloads of fiction picture books to shelve. There was so much competition. Back then, there was no separate category for nonfiction picture books, and not many in that category were being published. There was a hole in the market, and I decided to fill it. That's why I moved toward nonfiction. The two genres are very hard to compare, but I obviously enjoy writing nonfiction, or I wouldn't keep doing it. How do you decide what to write? It depends. Sometimes I start with a keyword search on the internet, like inventor or child inventor. I've also stumbled upon interesting stories. Then, at other times, I write about something I want to learn more about, such as becoming a firefighter or astronaut. There's a photograph of a firefighter. Megan still likes playing firefighter. For her book, Firefighter's Handbook, she visited fire stations in both New York and Rhode Island, spoke to many friendly firefighters, and asked them a ton of questions about their jobs and equipment. How long does it take to create a book, from when you get an idea to when the book is published? It varies, but my book, Action, about the invention of movies, took more than 2 years to create. Each nonfiction book has taken at least a year. My fiction books were created in a much shorter time period. In fact, my first book was finished in 2 months. Of course, I got little sleep. How do you start a book? Do you write the story first, make sketches first, or work on them at the same time? The first thing I do is gather as much information as possible, so that I have a solid grasp of the subject matter. After I have a good working knowledge of the topic, I pitch the idea to my editor. If she likes it, then I'll go ahead and write a rough draft. after I get a contract for the project and I'm paid a portion of the advance, I'll start polishing the draft. I go through many, many drafts. I will also start working on the sketches. When finished, I send the sketches with text to my editor and art director. We usually go back and forth for a while until the text and art match up to their liking. After that's approved, then I get to start the final art. There are illustrations of the sketches and final art. How much research do you do? How long does it take? Said Avery. The research can take quite a while. I try to gather every last bit of information possible. Each project is different and requires a different approach. For example, for Earmuffs for Everyone, about Chester Greenwood, the inventor of earmuffs, I took a rather woodsy drive to Maine to lay eyes on Greenwood's house and place of burial. I contacted the local historical society, and I documented it all so that I could reference the photos when working on the final art. I also sifted through tons of old patents. For Daredevil, about stunt pilot Betty Skelton, I scheduled an appointment at the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center, an annex of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Virginia. A man wheeled out carts full of Betty Skelton's personal photos and articles that she donated. I donned a pair of white cloth gloves and carefully combed through the collection. A nonfiction writer also has to read a lot. I order every book on the topic and gather every last news article I can find. An author also has to be comfortable approaching knowledgeable people. I was a rather shy person when I started my career, but I'm not now. There are photographs of the covers of Earmuffs for Everyone and Daredevil. What are you working on now? I'm working on a book about the first man to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail. I got really into hiking during the pandemic. Nature is the ultimate escape, so I wanted my next book to be about that. I'm currently painting a plethora of trees and rocks. Would you change anything about any of your old books? Ha ha! I sure would. I can't even look at my first book. My style has changed so much. I generally don't read a book once it's published, because I'll just pick it apart and note all the things I do differently. If kids want to be authors or illustrators, what should they do to start? Write, 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 read. Believe it or not, I don't always enjoy reading, but I still recommend it. For artists, draw and paint all the time. Never stop working on your craft. What part of your job do you enjoy most? Learning. Thanks, Megan, said Avery. Visit Megan-McCarthy, MCCARTHY.com, to learn more about Megan and her work. The next article is on page 10, entitled Three Cheers for 3D Printing by Tracy Vonder Brink. The owl says, makers use 3D printers to create everything from toys to artificial bones. 3D printing is a relatively new way to make solid objects. 3D printers can be small enough to fit on a desk or large enough to print a whole house. Many school and library makerspaces now have 3D printers. You may even have used one yourself. But how does 3D printing work? Marvin says to Bot, can we add a 3D printer? And Bot says, makerspaces already have plenty. Making models. All 3D printing starts with computer design. Makers use special software to create a digital model of what they want to print. It could be something simple, like a fidget spinner, or it might be a prosthetic hand that needs lots of parts. The computer program takes the maker's design and puts it into a language the 3D printer understands. After the maker designs the model, the computer sends the instructions to the 3D printer. 3D printers build objects by squeezing out thin layers of material that stack up. It's a bit like toothpaste coming out of a tube. The layers can be plastic, metal, glass, and even concrete. Some printers turn a liquid called resin into a solid. 3D printers in a library or school usually use thin plastic thread called filament. It comes in every color you can imagine. The filament is wound around spools and goes into the 3D printer. When the print job starts, the printer pulls in the filament and melts it. The melted plastic goes into a nozzle and is squeezed out one layer at a time, following the maker's design. Then the plastic hardens as it cools. There is a photograph of the filament as well as the 3D printer. Zia says, "So many pretty colors." There's a photograph. Prosthetic hands can be 3D printed inexpensively for growing kids who need new ones. Another photograph shows printing an action figure with supports. Finishing it up, some objects made by a 3D printer are ready to use as soon as they come off the printer. Others take a little more work. The printer sprays supports around some objects so they don't fall over while being printed. When an object is printed with supports, the maker needs to pull or smooth them off by hand. Objects made with resin must be put under a special ultraviolet or UV light or outside in the sun after the print is done to make them strong. To create something complex, such as a prosthetic hand, makers print all the parts separately and then fasten them together to make the finished piece. 3D printing doesn't always work the first time. The design might not be right. Sometimes the printer makes a mistake and squeezes out layers in a messy pile, makers call spaghetti. When this happens, the maker has to check the design and the printer and try again. In another photograph, Bone Pony comments, "The filament goes from the spool and into the printer." In the next photograph, Marvin shows us failed print spaghetti. The future. 3D printing continues to grow. Some companies are building houses with 3D printers that use concrete. A medical company is 3D printing a bone-like material that doctors can use to repair broken bones. Some scientists hope that one day they'll be able to 3D print organs, such as hearts or lungs, to replace damaged ones. What do you think should be 3D printed next? In the photograph, 3D printed bones and organs are currently used to help train doctors and plan surgeries. 3D printing a house in another photograph using concrete. 3D printed homes at the Community First Village in Austin, Texas are shown in the photograph. Elvis says, "I wish someday that I could see a 3D printed home for me." Page 14, Making Marvin by Tracy von der Brink. With the right computer program and a 3D printer, even Marvin can become an action figure. Here's how the Ask team did it. "Me? Wow," said Marvin. First, we used a computer program to design how Marvin should look. Of course, he had to be on a skateboard. "Of course," he said. We chose a color and loaded the spool of filament into the 3D printer. We thought Marvin would look good in light blue. "I agree, although purple is nice too, or maybe gold," said Zia. The computer sent the file to the printer. After the printer warmed up for a few minutes, it was ready to go. "How exciting," says Bone Pony. The printer pulled the filament inside and melted it. It sent the melted plastic into this piece called an extruder. It has a nozzle on the bottom that squeezes out the plastic in layers. The first layer didn't look much like Marvin. Plush Pottum said, "Are you sure you're making Marvin?" The nozzle moved back and forth over and over. Can you see the wheels on Marvin's skateboard now? Avery says, I can see them. Getting closer. How much longer? Almost finished. The figure is standing up so the printer made supports as it built the layers. Avery says, the printer adds supports so the figure doesn't fall over while it's printing. It took almost 3 hours for the printer to finally finish, but we weren't done yet. We had to remove the supports. Marvin said, need any help with that stuff? Ta-da! Here's our 3D printed Marvin. Do me next, says Ratsputin. If you'd like to 3D print your own Marvin, visit cricketmedia.com/3DMarvin for a copy of the computer file. On page 16 and 17 are two projects that you can do with your parent, teacher, or guardian. Page 18, Handmade History by Meg Moss, Art by Michael Chesworth. Long ago, before factories and shopping malls, people made everything they needed from stuff in their own backyards. The Plant of Plenty. In ancient Egypt, the banks of the Nile River were thick with a beautiful plant called papyrus. To the Egyptians of 4,000 years ago, papyrus was like plastic is to us. Almost everything was made out of it. Papyrus is a tall reed with a feathery top that grew in the Nile's waters. Papyrus is most famous for the paper that can be made from its stalks. The ancient Egyptians invented the process and kept it a secret for thousands of years, but they used papyrus for a lot more. The sturdy stalks could be pounded and woven into mats, curtains, and sunshades. In papyrus boxes and baskets, Egyptians stored everything from figs to wigs. Papyrus could be twisted into thin string or sturdy rope to tie up bundles or harness animals or dip water from a well. Egyptians wore papyrus, sat on it, slept on it, and ate on it. They also sailed in it. Papyrus boats with papyrus sails and lines traveled up and down the Nile. It's no surprise that versatile papyrus became the symbol of ancient Egypt for its beauty and its usefulness. There are lots of illustrations of all these uses. Cool hats. In this picture, an Egyptian noblewoman stands before three gods. But what's it painted on? Papyrus paper, of course. This picture is around 3,100 years old. Okay, these look a lot like your flip-flops. Can you tell which parts are made of papyrus? The toe thongs and cross pieces are papyrus. The rest is woven grass. This ancient papyrus lid was fit for a king. Which king? This lid was part of King Tutankhamun's embalming cache. It covered a jar that probably held either funeral food or materials used to mummify the king. A little help from the bees. Humans realized a long time ago that the tiny honeybee could be a big helper. Bees make two materials that are as good as gold, honey and wax. In Europe, about 500 years ago, honey was the only way to sweeten food. Raw honeycomb was a sweet treat for kids to suck on. Grown-ups enjoyed a drink made of fermented honey called mead. Because it fights bacteria, honey also made a soothing, if sticky, ointment for skinned knees. Bees build a wax comb to put their honey in. They make wax in their bodies, chew it to soften it, and then shape it into hexagonal, six-sided tubes. Medieval people used bees' wax to make all kinds of things, especially candles. Wax candles gave off less smoke and smelled nicer than candles made from animal fat. Ladies stiffened thread for sewing with beeswax. students wrote on beeswax-covered tablets. Flat boards, not iPads, with sharp sticks for pencils. To seal letters in the days before gummed envelopes, noblemen and women used big blobs of melted wax stamped with fancy seals. And hundreds of years before plastic wrap, wax made an excellent covering for cheese. The bee says, happy to share. In the illustration, there are shown lots of uses for bees' products. Know your beeswax? Let's see. Every medieval seamstress had this in her sewing kit. What is it? A hunk of beeswax for stiffening thread. Why would medieval students want these in their backpacks? Small wax tablets were good for taking or passing notes in class. No envelope licking necessary, but why not? Because a blob of melted beeswax would keep your letter closed. People still use these today. What are they? Beeswax candles, of course. In the Middle Ages, they were a luxury used mostly by the rich or in churches. Avery says, is it true that you can catch more flies with honey? And Ratsputin says, yes. He's covered in flies and honey. Gifts from the buffalo. Before white settlers nearly wiped them out, as many as 75 million buffalo roamed the American countryside. For the native peoples, each buffalo was a walking grocery store, hardware, clothing, and toy store. From its horns to its tail, this huge animal provided materials to make at least 50 things, not counting food, that a tribe needed to live. On the High Plains, the Sioux people were skilled buffalo hunters. The animal's furry hide made cozy blankets and robes for the cold winters. Scraped clean of fur, the skin made rawhide, a hard, smooth leather that was used for shields, moccasin soles, perfleches, a kind of bag, and drums. With a little more work, hide could be made into soft leather for clothing. The fur went into pillows, and the horns were used on headdresses for warriors. Bones could be carved into spoons, knives, arrowheads, and even paintbrushes and toys. String-like sinew softened by chewing was perfect for bowstrings and sewing. Children played with buffalo leather dolls, and moms made soap and candles from the fat. On the treeless high plains, dried buffalo poop, or buffalo chips, were burned for fuel in cooking fires. Some say it added a good flavor to grilled meat. Finely ground dry buffalo chips made a soothing powder to put inside babies' diapers. So many useful things, all thanks to the buffalo. The illustration shows many uses of the buffalo. Elvis says, technically, these are gifts from the bison. Zia says, but the name buffalo has been traditionally used for hundreds of years. The buffalo says, you'll have to catch me first. Baffled by buffalo? Test yourself. Whee! Can't wait for winter to try this out. What is it? A sled made of buffalo ribs. These horn spoons were for stirring stew. But how do you think a Sioux cook might have used the buffalo bladder? As a canteen to hold water. Jewelry? No, more fun than that. What is it? A game made from deer and buffalo bones. It's called a perfleche, but what is it? A rawhide bag, kind of like a suitcase. Mail order houses. What if your house came in a box, like a model plane? Some assembly required. November 1st, 1919. Dear homebuyer, congratulations on your purchase of a Langston house. Using our handy pre-cut lumber and detailed plans, you will soon be relaxing in your very own home, built entirely by you. Your house kit is on its way. Before it arrives, you might want to 1. Buy some land. 2. Put in water, sewer, and electric lines if you want to take baths and have light. And 3. Dig a basement and lay a sturdy brick or stone foundation. Everything else you'll need will arrive in a sealed railroad boxcar. We'll start with the house frame and nails, followed by floors, walls, roof, and insides over the next few weeks. Everything is included, even the kitchen sink. Once your boxcar arrives, you will need to go out to the rail yard, break the seal, and check that the 24,000 pieces of your house are all present and correct. Bring a wagon and some strong friends to help you haul all that lumber to your building site. Hope it isn't too far. Our experts estimate that an average person should easily be able to finish a house in about 90 days, but feel free to hire a carpenter to help. When it's finished, your new home will fit right into the neighborhood. Our kits copy all the most popular house styles. Only you will ever know it's homemade. If you like your new house, consider adding a barn or stable, also available in easy build kits. Animals not included. It's true. Between 1908 and 1940, along with underwear and engine parts, shoppers could order an entire house from mail order catalogs like Sears and Montgomery Ward. Each board was numbered for easy assembly. Many of these homes still stand. Is there one hiding in your neighborhood? In Carlinville, Illinois, the Standard Oil Company ordered an entire neighborhood out of a catalog to house its workers. There's one shown in the photograph. Of course, you do have to follow the instructions, unlike the hero of this movie, who has built a house that looks like it's going to fall down. Plush Potom says, "I don't know. How hard could it be?" Marvin says, "How hard could it be?" Page 26. Making a Name, art by William Brown. Do you know anyone called Smith? He or she probably does not make things out of metal, but there's a chance one of their ancestors did. Marvin says to Plush Potom, "So did your ancestors make hippie pots?" "Hippopotamus means river horse," she said. Last names or family names started out as a handy way to tell people apart when many people had the same first name. Who owes tax? John the tailor, John the son of Jack, or John from Jersey? Over time, these second names became permanent family names. Some last names come from places, John Jersey, or from a parent's first name, John Jackson. But many tell what people did or made for a living. They're a little peek into family history. Bannister, basket maker. Chandler, candle maker. Cooper, barrel maker. Fletcher, arrow maker. Fuller, cloth finisher. Kunkel, spindle maker. Schumacher, shoemaker. Smith, metal worker. Wainwright, or Wayne, wagon maker. Weaver, cloth maker. And Wheeler, wheel maker. On page 27, there's an exercise you can do with your parent, teacher, or guardian, as well as on page 28, there's another one. Page 29. Ask Jimmy and the Bug. Words by Ellen Braff. Pictures by Dean Stanton. "Yo, Bug," MMAR from Ohio asked, "what is the coldest thing on Earth?" The coldest natural thing on Earth is a spot in Antarctica where temperatures have dipped to negative 144 Fahrenheit or negative 98 centigrade. But scientists have created things even colder than Antarctica by chilling them to near absolute zero. What's absolute zero? It's the coldest temperature possible. Atoms and molecules, the tiny particles that make up matter, jiggle around all the time. That jiggling is heat. The colder something is, the less energy its particles have, and the slower we move. Absolute zero is the temperature at which everything stops moving. It's impossible to get any colder than that. So how cold is absolute zero? Negative 460 degrees Fahrenheit, which equals negative 273 degrees centigrade. In special laboratories, scientists use lasers to steal energy from atoms until they're almost not moving, close to absolute zero. When they get this cold, the atoms collapse into a big clump. There's no space between them. They sort of form one monster atom. Scientists call this weird stuff a Bose-Einstein condensate, and for just a few moments, it's the coldest thing on Earth. Wow, that's really cool. Have a question? Bug us anytime. ask@cricketmedia.com. On the next pages are some contests and letters and other things that you can do with your parent, teacher, or guardian. Also on page 33, meet Marvin and friends. That's it for this installment of Ask, November, December, Science and Exploration for Curious Kids. I'm Chris Radio volunteer Ron Pariser. So long until next time.